Thank you once again, Pastor Paul and Mia, to the rest of you for being on time and for still hanging out after lunch. It's a tough call always to stay on and to hear what comes after lunch. But here we are. And in this session, I would like to share with you on the letters R and A. So R, can we see R? All right, a revelation of who Israel is. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8, a foundational verse. As I move among Christians and churches, I'm beginning to become acutely aware that more and more Christians are very desirous to find their God-given destiny, and as nations, to find our God-given destiny. Now, for anyone to come to believe that a nation can carry a destiny, one has to first subscribe to the idea of Israel. Because Israel, by virtue of being the firstborn, if Israel does not carry a destiny, then by default, none of us carry destinies as nations. And the only reason why you and I can subscribe to this biblical idea that Australia may have a God-given destiny, that Singapore may have a God-given destiny, simply comes out from the fact that because deep in our hearts we believe that because Israel had a destiny. And the reason why nations are struggling to find their God-given destiny, I have come to reason this, is simply because in their failed connection with Israel. In Exodus 4 and verse 22, you and I are given a very categorical statement from God himself. This is not Moses now, but God in the first person instructing Moses to stand before Pharaoh and to say to Pharaoh, Israel is my son, my firstborn son. Now, let's try to unpack that verse. Why in the world would God call Israel a son? Israel, the nation, is a son. Because we see nations as nations. Try asking anyone, how do you define a nation? And we try giving the capital, the currency, the culture, the communications, things like that. But as far as God is concerned, from out there, he's looking down upon planet Earth. He says nations as son. And the very idea comes from Exodus 4 and verse 22, where God says, Israel is my son. First revelation. Second revelation, my firstborn son. So he punctuates that sentence by saying, Israel is my firstborn son. Now, for God to say anything like that, he must mean something. In other words, if you come to my home, and if I introduce my son to you, and I say, this is Christopher, my son. What do you get out of that? Well, you know that Christopher was born to me. He's my son. But what if I say to you, Israel is my firstborn son? I'm giving you two information now. Not just one information, I'm giving you two pieces of information. That not only is he my son, he's my firstborn son, meaning I have other sons. Otherwise, technically, I cannot call him my firstborn son, if he's my only son. So for God to call Israel as my firstborn son, he's not only looking to Israel as his son, a nation as a son, but he sees the nations as sons. Now, this is the first revelation we need for those of us who come outside of Israel. But for us to find our God-given destiny, we must recognize, realize, and remember that Israel is the firstborn son of God. In other words, in our natural families, like myself, Kevin Lemon, the Christian author, calls this the birth order. We need to recognize the birth order in any given family. So I was the firstborn son, but I have a sister who was born before me. So we recognize the firstborn, and the firstborn remains always, was, is, and always the firstborn. And then comes everyone else, the second, the third, and the fourth. So we need to take our place recognizing that. So, for instance, when the prophet Samuel was in Bethlehem, he was trying to identify the next king following Saul's disobedience. Jesse, the father, lined up the sons in order of their birth, in their birth order. Firstborn, secondborn. Why is that? Because that's how Middle Eastern culture is all about. The firstborn. The firstborn. So once we understand that, then we need to take two steps back and say, so what is it going to take for Singapore to recognize its destiny? So today we have many different things saying about this and that. Like, for example, Australia, the great Southern of the Holy Spirit. That's good. Smith Wigglesworth, fantastic. Chorus 1606, fantastic. But how is it tied to Israel? Because if you don't, your destiny is connected with Israel, that destiny doesn't stand before God. Every nation has to find its destiny by virtue of its connection with Israel. That's how Singapore came to discover its destiny as the Antioch of Asia. When you go back to the book of Acts, chapter 11, 12, and 13, what you learn about the church of Antioch in Israel was that of its connection with Jerusalem, Israel. So as long as Singapore remains rightly connected with Israel, then the possibility of Singapore coming to discover her God-given destiny becomes very real. In the absence of that, no. Which is why Satan fights it. Satan does not want any nation to come into their God-given destiny. Satan, by nature, is a stealer, killer, and a destroyer. That's what he does, full-time. Not part-time, full-time. So he steals the destinies of nation. He kills the destinies of nation, and he destroys the destinies of Israel. Why is he doing what he's doing with Israel? Because Israel's destiny is called to be a blessing to all nations. Satan knows that. So to destroy Israel is number one hot list. He must destroy Israel, because if Israel is allowed to live, then Israel will end up becoming a blessing to all nations. But then Jesus goes on to say that in Matthew 25, as part of the Olivet Discourse, he begins to speak about dividing the nation as sheep nations and goat nations. So if you do your research and your final analysis in that area, you will discover that eventually sheep nations come into their God-given destiny. Goat nations will be denied their God-given destiny. Why? Because of their connection, disconnection with Israel, bottom line. So for Australia to come into a God-given destiny, I've been praying for Australia for some time, and is there something that is true about Australia that is equally true about Australia and Israel? All right, I know what was prophesied, 1606, the Great Southland, the Holy Spirit, and all that. So that's good. That goes well with me. But for a destiny to be sustainable to the end times, you come into your God-given destiny, you need to connect with Israel. What is Israel saying to Australia? So what I hear Israel saying to Australia is that 100 years ago, when Israel was about to face its greatest threat from the Ottoman Empire, 800 light horsemen wearing Australian hats stood in the gap. So some of you were in Australia on October 31st to commemorate this. For me, what's important is, while history is greatly important, what Australia has done for Israel in the past stands before God. Our God is a God who remembers. That word remember occurs 263 times in the Bible, which is a reminder to you and I, our God remembers. He does not suffer from amnesia. All right? And he's not into dementia as well. He remembers. So he remembers what God, Australia has done in the past. But the big question is, what will Australia do in the future, in the present and the future? So this is where the church in Australia needs to take her bearings and then once again turn Australia towards Israel. What happened last Wednesday was a step away from Israel. Okay, what happened last Wednesday was a step. So that devil is very intent. His strategy is very intentional to take Australia, turn Australia away. New Zealand did that last year when at the UN, when they decided to sanction the establishment of the unilateral state of Palestine. Immediately, Netanyahu withdrew his ambassador from New Zealand. So New Zealand was part of the Light Horsemen, ANZAC. But the churches are not remembering. You know, God says in Isaiah 43, verse 23, put me into remembrance, put me into remembrance. You want to argue your case, put me into remembrance. So when we pray for Australia, we have to go record, Lord, October 31st, 1917, Australia was there for Israel. Put me into remembrance, says the Lord. So you and I have to find how in the past our nations were tied, connected with Israel. So here we are, realizing and recognizing the fact that no nation can find her true God-given destiny until and unless they touch Israel in a way that's right before God. How did I find my destiny? People, allow me to make a statement. Every servant of the Lord, from Genesis to Revelation, what's the common denominator? Be it Abraham, be it Moses, be it Joshua, be it David, be it John the Baptist, be it Paul, be it John. Genesis to Revelation, what was the common denominator? Every servant of the Lord in the Bible was either directly or indirectly connected with Israel. That's the bottom line. Find me one who wasn't. You can't. And yet today, we as a church believe that we can exist independently of Israel and can still find our destiny. Why are Christians so lost? Ask a Christian. Are you walking in the perfect will of God? They give you a stare and a blank. What do you mean? I mean, are you walking in the perfect will of God? That question is foreign to many Christians. Why? Why is that a foreign idea to us? Ask Abraham, are you walking in the will of God? What do you think? Ask David, are you walking in the perfect will of God? What do you think? Ask Paul, are you walking in the perfect will? It's a no-brainer. Of course I am. Ask a Christian today. They don't have a clue. At least not the Christians in Singapore. Maybe the Christians in Australia. Maybe they do. Why? Why are we in this sad state where we don't even know if we are in the perfect will of God? That's because Israel has been taken out of the equation. Either directly or indirectly, we are all expected to connect with Israel. In my case, directly. I am there. In some of your cases, directly. Like Fiona and Pete, they are connected directly. Their entire life revolves around Israel, bringing the Jewish people back. But for others, it may be indirectly from where you are. But the fact that Israel remains the center of everything that God is doing in our lives remains unaltered. Deuteronomy 32 and verse 8. So here it says, when the Most High created the nations, he divided them according to the sons of Israel. Which is why my friend Tom has in Jerusalem, he has come up with this map of the world with Jerusalem in the center and then the 12 gateways. The 12 gates, so you have 3 in the north, 3 in the south, 3 in the west, 3 in the east. Where did he get this idea? New Jerusalem, Revelation 21. 12 gates, 3 in the north, 3 in the south, 3 in the west, 3 in the east. So it's a very biblical worldview. But that's how God sees. So as far as God is concerned, he divided all nations according to the sons of Israel. What does that mean? That none of us as nation can ever find our destiny without coming to terms that Israel is the firstborn son of God. None of us. So this is where we need to begin praying that our nation, our respective nations, will be able to find their bearings as they are seeking to find their destiny. Australia. What happened last Wednesday happened because of a variety of reasons. But one main reason was because of a pull factor. Australia is trying very hard, very, very hard, to say to itself that it's part of the West and not the East. Politically, you're part of the West. Prophetically, you're part of the East. Now, this is undeniably true. If you were a part of the West, you should be freezing cold now, because it's winter in the West. But it's not winter here. Even nature is trying to say to Australia, you're not part of the West. You're part of the East. The fact that geography places you on the Eastern Hemisphere and not in the Western Hemisphere is yet another statement coming from God, that God placed Australia in the East and not in the West. And yet everything within the DNA of Australia leans towards the West. I can understand why. Your history puts that pressure on you. And I've gone before parliaments here in Israel, in Australia, saying that until and unless you accept your place and your position here in the East, placed by God, you will never come into your God-given destiny. Australia will never come into your God-given destiny. Now, for Australia to say that we are part of the West, then what you're also saying by the same token is, everything is over. You are not to expect anything from God as far as Australia is concerned. Why? Because when you study history, what began in Jerusalem, the center of the earth, everything went westward. As you study the book of Acts, Acts 1 to 5, Jerusalem, Acts 6, 7, 8, Samaria. Moving on to Acts 11, Antioch. And then Acts 16, Europe. And then for the next 1,500 years, Europe. And then America. So what we study in history is, that's the subject of my book, the first half. The first half was all about the West. The first half was all about the West. History was all about the West. So the question then comes, so what about us in the East? We come in the second half. And right now we are in the second half. First half is over. Now the second half has begun. When did it begin? It began last year. Time does not allow me as to say why, read the book, but we are now in the second half. And this time around, God is picking players to play the second half from Pacific and Asia. Here, the dominant nations that played the first half were Europe and America. Here, it would be Pacific and Asia, the islands and the mainlands, what Jesus would call the end of the earth. The end of the earth is the Pacific Islands. Right, those of you who have difficulty understanding what I'm trying to say, Jesus said in Acts chapter 1 and verse 6 to the question, Lord, will you restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? Will you at this time restore the kingdom? Jesus' reply was, not yet. Not yet. Not until the gospel has reached the end of the earth. Now, unfortunately, many of our English translations has that as the ends, as in plural, ends of the earth. But in the original and in the literal translation, you will not find the plural ends of the earth, but end of the earth. So Jesus was not referring to the north, south, east, west. He was referring to one particular point of geography. Question, where is that? So if you take a cup, imagine this is round, it's orange, and this represents the center, orange, the eye of the orange, and this is Jerusalem. So if I were to take a sharp object and to pin it this way, Jerusalem, center of the earth, let it pop up on the other side. What's this? Pacific. That's why I firmly believe that the second half is to be played by the Pacific and Asia. First the Pacific and then Asia. And Australia is a key player. Which is why the devil is working overtime to deny you your God-given destiny. Trying to push you to believe that you're part of the West. You're not part of the West. Look at Australia today. 3 out of 4 are Asians. Come on. Even a blind man can say that. So God, in his sovereign grace and mercy, have planned something, planted something, And it's intending to promote Australia to be something and someone in the future. But the devil is working over time to undo that. So first, Australia needs to recognize its connection with Israel. Second, Australia needs to recognize its position, its placing in the East, not in the West. And as soon as Australia does that, we are on our way to let Australia become a key player in the end times. Some of us have heard of replacement theology. We prayed about that in the first session. I need to stop at 1:30, right? Correct, Pastor? 1:30, yeah? Yeah, I think so. All right, let's move to the next slide. Okay, this is the one that I was making reference to, Thomas. So, 1:45, okay. I still have half an hour. Now, see this? This is Jerusalem as the center. And whose idea was that Jerusalem is the center? Why not Sydney? Now, I can pick up a map from some of their souvenir shops, which has Australia as the center. Have you seen one of that? Yeah, I've seen one of that where Australia is the center. I mean, whoever was the cartographer had some ideas. He says, why must I? No, let Australia be the center. I mean, you can put whatever you want. But according to Ezekiel 5 and verse 5, according to Ezekiel 38 and verse 12, Jerusalem was, is, and always shall be the center. Now, you and I need to ask ourselves the question, why? Why must Jerusalem and Jerusalem alone be the center? People, wash my hand here. Revelation 4 and 5, okay? This is Revelation 1, 2, and 3, the seven churches. Revelation 4 and 5 is that one chapter where God invites John to come up, you know? So I saw a door standing open in heaven, and the voice which spoke to me, come up here, said, come up here, and I'll show you what must soon take place. And then I was the Spirit, and I was taken up. And if you read chapter 4, the word throne appears 11 times. You read chapter 5, the word throne appears 5 times, okay? Everything was about the throne. So what do you see? In the midst was a throne, before the throne, behind the throne, around the throne. In the midst was a throne, before the throne, around the throne, behind the throne. Everything was centered on the throne. The fact that throne had to be in the center, this is heaven. The throne had to be in the center, in the midst. Now, heaven, earth, parallel universe. So in heaven, the midst, center, the throne. Earth, center, midst, throne, Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the throne of the Lord. So this is not for negotiation. It's not for debate, not for discussion. Okay, it's been settled in the courts of heaven, Jerusalem. So once we understand that, then we need to understand every other thing. So replacement theology that has deep roots here in this part of Australia. So what exactly is it about? Can we have the next slide, right? Okay, Asia Pacific. Now, why is it that the last book in the Bible, namely the book of Revelation, why is it that Jesus singles out the churches in Asia? Have you ever wondered that? Why would Jesus single out the churches in Asia? Revelation 1 and verse 4, Revelation 1 and verse 19. John, I want you to write this letters to the seven churches that are in Asia. Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea, seven churches. But in Asia, why? Historically, if you try to track down these churches, and I've been to the seven churches too many times, I lost count. Okay, they are today, if you try to track down the seven churches that were in Asia, the book of Revelation, you can find them in Turkey. All right? Now, this everyone knows, but what everyone does not know, or at least what most do not know, is all seven churches found in Turkey are found on the Asian side of Turkey, not on the European side of Turkey. Okay? Turkey has an Asian side and a European side divided by the Bosporus River. Why would Jesus single out the seven churches that are on the Asian side of Turkey? Why would Jesus do that? Question. The book of Revelation was being written in AD 96. Why wasn't Jesus saying something to the church in Rome? Why hasn't he doesn't say something to the church in Corinth? What about the church in Thessalonica? They were still around. You see, this is the understanding you and I need. When the gospel began to come out of Jerusalem, okay, so here was, everything was directed to the West. The book of Acts was all about the West. What began in Jerusalem ended in Rome. Acts 1, Jerusalem, Acts 28, Rome. So the book of Acts was all directed to the church in the West. That's the first coming. Now Jesus at his second coming has a message for the churches in Asia. When we say Asia, we are speaking about Pacific Asia, Melanesia, Micronesia, Macronesia, Polynesia, Asia. We are talking about Pacific Asia. And the devil is doing a wonderful job with Australia, trying to deny her God-given destiny by saying, you're part of the West. But if Australia insists it's part of the West, you are out of the game. The game in the West is over. First half is over. Try to understand that. First half is over. What is about to be played now is the second half. So does Australia want to play the second half? And God has given an invitation to Australia. Play the second half. But is Australia willing to take that call? For that to happen, Australia must recognize the goalpost is Jerusalem. Everything must end to Jerusalem. Back to Jerusalem. Everything ends in Jerusalem. Australia need to recognize that. But for that to happen, Australia need to receive Israel. Second, here in Australia, you and I need to understand that for Australia to come into a God-given destiny, not only must she recognize Israel, but within Australia, you have to uproot this thing called replacement theology. Now, replacement theology, most of you know what replacement theology is. Somebody prayed that it's all about the church replacing Israel, all right? So that's the essence of it. But replacement theology goes much deeper, and it is really scary. Okay, so watch my hand now, okay? When Israel exported what it exported, they exported what we call the gospel of the kingdom. Okay, and that's the only gospel we have. The gospel of the kingdom. But by the time the gospel of the kingdom was exported to Europe, at a certain point in history, the gospel of the kingdom was cut short to become only the gospel. Today, you and I don't speak about the gospel of the kingdom. We speak only about the gospel. What do we mean by that? To speak only about the gospel restricts us, refrains us to speak only about the Jesus of the first coming. That he died on the cross. If you believe in him, you'll make it, you have a place in heaven. That's the gospel. The gospel of the kingdom is the first coming plus the second coming. You have to end the story. This Jesus is coming back as king to rule the nations. You see, in a single stroke, by taking one word out of the equation, gospel of the kingdom becomes the gospel. We don't see the damage, but the damage was by taking the word kingdom out, the devil successfully engineered his scheme. He took the nations out of the equation. Because there's no reason for nations to come into their God-given destiny if it's not a kingdom. It's only a gospel. Our focus is on individuals. But the gospel of the kingdom demands that you and I disciple not only individuals, we disciple nations, entire nations. What does it mean to disciple a nation? To disciple a nation is to bring that nation into a God-given destiny. What else is there? So when I am, as a pastor, I'm called to disciple a new convert. What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to give him four steps or what? No, the whole purpose of discipleship as a pastor to my member is I must disciple that person, boy, girl, man, woman, to come into her or his God-given destiny. That's the purpose of discipleship. Now, at the macro level, discipling a nation is to bring a nation into a God-given destiny. But the churches can't catch that. Why not? Because it has lost sight of the gospel of the kingdom. And in one stroke, the nations were taken out of the equation. So we no longer have a burden for a nation. We no longer have the burden to pray for our nation. We don't see the necessity to disciple our nation. Because Everything is about the individual gospel. So not only he successfully took the nations out of the equation, in taking the nations out of the equation, he took Israel, the nation, also out of the equation. Which is why we are lost in the wilderness today. So this is what happened in the first half, and that's why we lost the game in the first half. By the time the first half ended, I said it ended last year, all right? First half ended last year. Take the score. Tell you the score. What was the score? The score was Satan scored 5, the church scored 2. How did I get the number? Based on the current population of the world and the number of people who profess to follow Christ and those who profess not to follow Christ by design or by default. So who won? Satan won. So we as Christians alive today have to ask this pertinent, profound question. So what does it take to win the game? Now we have come to the second half. We lost the game in the first half. Now we have come into the second half and we must win this game. What must we do to win this game? And we have the same professors who lost the game on this side coming to our side and training us how to win the game. Come on! You lost the game. What possibly can you teach me? If I play the game with you played, I lose. So we need to ask ourselves, so what do we do? Why did the church lose the first half? First reason, because they threw the star players out of the field. Who are the star players? The scorers. See, in any football game or any game or whatever, you cannot win any game by defending. You can only win a game by scoring. Am I right? Talk to me. Am I right? Yeah. So when you get the forwards out, if you understand football, you have the center forward, the three forward, right wing, left wing, okay? And then you have the midfield, and then you have the two backs, and then the goalkeeper, okay? You have everybody in position behind, but your forwards are taken out, your three forwards are taken out. How in the world are you going to score? You can't. You can only defend. After the first two goals, in 83-1-3, Constantine came on the scene. He became the emperor of the Byzantine Empire. And then in 325, he passed the Nicene Creed. With that, he divided the Old and the New Testament. He introduced man's calendar, the Christian calendar, as opposed to the Jewish calendar. And then he says, we have nothing to do with the feasts. It all began in 313, 325, 80. And then the rest is history. So after the church scored the first two goals, because for the first 300 years, we were still one. There was tension. But we were still one in the Messiah, Jews and Gentiles, one in the Messiah. And we were unstoppable, unbeatable, invincible. And the devil saw that. He says, I have to divide this team. And so we ended up taking the forwards out. He says, go, we'll play the rest of the game. We played defense. The rest. That's one main reason why we lost the game. Second reason why we lost the game. We lost sight of the goalpost. The goalpost was, is, and always shall be Jerusalem. We shifted the goalpost to Sydney, to Singapore, to Jakarta. Third reason why we lost the game. For the first 300 years, we still had apostles, prophets, evangelists, teachers, pastors in the church. Once the Pope came, the apostles and the prophets were taken out of the equation. How can you ever win any game without the apostles and the prophets? You can't. They are the ones who break new ground and plant churches. But the church has decided to do away with them. And here in the Australian church, I have many talking about, oh, I'm an apostle, I'm an apostle. So what do you do? What do you do? You are defined by what you do, yeah. Yeah, you can go on carrying cards. You know, I'm apostle, this apostle. What do you do? Show me the fruits. Apostles, by virtue of their calling, are called to nations. All right, so if you are not at some point in your apostolic calling, discipling your nation or discipling some other nation, then please call yourself some other thing, but don't call yourself an apostle. You're a disgrace. We have far too many running around. Suddenly, pastors are all prophets and apostles now. Why? So people, I've given you just three main reasons why we lost. three main reasons. So here in the East, the second half, we need to recapture this. Australia, you have a job to do. You have a lot to pray. You don't have enough hours to pray. So on the one hand, you pray for Israel, yes, but you must pray for Australia. And then you pray for Australia and Israel. So you got to bounce between Australia and Israel, and then Australia and Israel. You got to marry them together. What God has put together, let no man put asunder. So there's a lot of prayer that's needed. I can understand why God is such in a hurry to open up 24/7 houses of prayer. How many of you have been to IHOP, Kansas City? All right. Anyone know when IHOP began? 1998. All right. Now, why 1998? Okay. I mean, God in His own way is saying some things to us. See, whenever God pours out His Spirit in Israel, there's always an overflow into the church. Always. Okay? Always. Where was Billy Graham before 1948? Nobody knows. Where was Oral Roberts before 1948? Nobody knows. Where was Catherine Kuhlman before 1948? Nobody knows. But the moment Israel is born, Billy Graham was born, Catherine Kuhlman, Oral Roberts. Why? 1967, where the Spirit of the Lord began to invade. 1967 was the year that we know of the Six-Day War, but it was also the year that many of the Jews who were hippies came to know Jesus. Many of the Jews came to know Jesus by the tons. So when that happened, there was an overflow in the church. We began to receive the baptism of the Holy Spirit. 1998, Israel turns 50, a jubilee, 48, 98. In that same year, God does something unimaginable in the church. In that same year, without one speaking to another, 24/7 House of Prayer was birthed in Kansas City, 24/7 House of Prayer was birthed in Kiev, 24/7 was birthed in Indonesia. Nobody spoke with one another. It just happened. Why? Every time God does something in Israel, there's always an overflow. Always an overflow. So when IHOP was all set to go, I actually had some input. Mike Bickle, the founder, was before that pastor of the Metro Fellowship. He was a pastor just like me. And as he was taking up this call to IHOP, pastors never could understand his call, and pastors had not good things to say about Mike. But when Mike was about to launch, I gave an input. I said, if you're launching, Mike, launch it during Sukkot. Don't just pick any month. Launch it during Sukkot. Why? I gave him the understanding. I said, because the Temple of Solomon was dedicated in Sukkot. The Tabernacle in the Wilderness was launched in Sukkot. So if you want something to go 24/7, you don't want the fire on the altar to die, Leviticus 6 and verse 12, do it according to God's calendar. So it was launched September 1988. Initially, Mike never had a revelation of Israel. For the first 2-3 years, nothing about Israel. But because he was sold out on intimacy, and anyone sold out on intimacy leaning his head on the bosom of Jesus, sooner or later has to hear the heartbeat of Jesus. Israel, Israel, Israel. Matter of time. You cannot say you are intimate and not hear about Israel. It doesn't. It's like me taking Coke and say, but there's no sugar in my body now. It's impossible. You take Coke, you are absorbing sugar. One cannot exist without the other. So as we are taking time to pray, remember we need to pray for Israel, but we need to pray for Australia. You need to give a lot of time for Australia, because Australia needs to come into a destiny by being a blessing to Israel. You were a blessing to Israel in no certain ways. No other nation comes close to you. If Israel exists today, part of the reason is because of Australia. And I've said this in the Knesset many a time. Without the Pacific, you don't exist today. They need to understand, but Australia needs to understand this. All right, you were this in the past, but who are you in the present, and who will you be in the prophetic future? So you are like the captain on a ship. The church is like the ship, and the Australia, the nation, is like a ship, and the church is the one at the helm. And prayers are the rudders. You need to steer this nation towards Israel. Towards Israel. Which is what I try to do with Papua New Guinea, which is what I'm trying to do with Indonesia, which is what I'm trying to do with Malaysia. With Malaysia, I'm having a tough time. But Papua New Guinea, God worked wonders. Papua New Guinea was a nation that was set dead against Israel for obvious reasons. The same missionaries who came to you were the same missionaries who came down to Papua New Guinea, replacement theology. So when I first went to Papua New Guinea, and there was this time when I was asked to speak at the prayer breakfast in the parliament. And amongst those in the gathering was the prime minister. So I asked the Lord, I said, Lord, what do you want me to say? And the Lord said, tell them about the secret behind Singapore's success. So I said, Lord, what? Speak to them about the secret behind Singapore's success. So what has Singapore got to do with this? Is there a chapter and a verse you would like to give me? Speak to them about the success, the real secret behind Singapore. So I said, okay, Lord, I'm not going to argue, I'm going to do that. So I said, well, this will be my first and last. So anyway, I shared about Singapore. But what I shared about Singapore was, the Singapore will not be what it is today, an island will not be what it is today if it wasn't for Israel. The God of Abraham, who remembered his covenant, remembered Israel, there was this huge portal out of which the blessings flowed down, and Israel prospered. Not just survived, thrived. But then what Lee Kuan Yew did was, he connected a small pipeline between Israel and this little island called Singapore. So what came down, part of it went this way. You understand the principle of irrigation. And we lived. We were supposed to die. No, we were supposed to die. We were given away to die. Nobody saw any future in Singapore. That's why Singapore today on National Day, they'll sing, no? There was a time when they said, we'll never make it. But we did. But we did. They still sing that song. I wrote to the Prime Minister's office, I said, stop singing the song. You're nursing your wounds. Because Malaysia is listening, you know, you're actually telling Malaysia, you made fun of us, now look at us, look at you. Stop singing that song. If you are Singaporean, you know what I'm talking about. If you're a Malaysian, please forgive me, minta maaf. Okay, minta maaf, yeah? So, but this is the thing, you see. But then, when I shared the story, at the end of the 20 minutes, the Prime Minister came says, thank you for your message. That was good. Let me invite you for tea in my office. So I didn't know what was coming, good or bad, you know. So I went to the office and he says, I'd like you to come again. Okay, I came again. I said something more about Israel. And then he said, come again. And something more. 2012, I had the joy of bringing the Prime Minister to Israel in person and introduce him to Benjamin Netanyahu. And while we were in session, I had this to say to Bibi. Bibi is something else. I said, sir, Papua New Guinea is a friend. You know, in 2006, when I spoke to almost all of Papua New Guinea, in the year following 2007, the Prime Minister drafted a document called a covenant with the God of Israel. And in drafting the covenant, I had a part to play. He signed, saying that we are now establishing, we are making a covenant with the God of Israel. Okay, now that was August 26, 2007. And from that day until now, Papua New Guinea has declared that comes August 26 each year, it will be a public holiday for the entire nation. And the entire nation is to pray for Israel. Now think about that. Now who am I to do that? In the words of Amos, who said, I'm not a shepherd, neither am I a son of a shepherd. I'm not a politician, neither am I a son of a politician. But I am a servant of the Lord. That I know. And I had a hand in discipling nations that I know. And I know how to point the nations in the right direction. That I know. This is what I've been taught. So finally, when I brought in my two-year-old baby, so they are your friends, they are praying for you, you know. They have one day holiday declared just to pray for Israel. Baby was so very moved. He says, all right, I'll take this up to task. And this year, for the first time, you know, Papua New Guineans have to come to Canberra to secure their visas. And Canberra doesn't make it easy for them to secure their visa. They have to produce their bank documents and this and that. They make it very hard. So I knew their pain, and I said, all right, let me work on this. So Bibi said, I lifted off. So as of this year, Papua New Guineans can walk into Israel without a visa. They don't even have to have secure a visa on arrival. They just walk in. So when I saw this happen, my heart was lifted up. My faith was boosted. I say, hey, boy, it's happening. It's happening. And you know, the best part of the story of Papua New Guinea was the year after they signed the covenant, they discovered their LNGs. LNG, yeah. Liquefied nitrogen gas, yeah. I mean, it was there all the time. Why didn't you discover before? God was hiding it. And the moment they said yes to Israel, God said, all right, now. I mean, today they are the world's largest reserves of LNG is in Papua New Guinea. Suddenly they are a nation with prosperity staring at them. From third world to first world. How did that happen? Israel. So Singapore's story, Israel. Now I tell Papua New Guinea's story to Indonesia. Israel. The same year, 2012. I had the grand privilege of bringing the minister for the economics. At that time was Naftali Bennett. Today he's an education minister. Some say he will be the next prime minister. We'll wait and see. But 2012, I opened the way for him to come to Jakarta, Indonesia. People say, nobody can. So I said, God, you gave me jurisdiction for Asia Pacific. In Singapore, that means you have 3 minutes. I'll finish this story. And so I said, okay, why not? You know, I say this story to you, and I'm saying this for the sake of Australia. I was given the impression, and with this story I close, Pastor, Indonesia is the largest Islamic nation in the world. Okay, Satan is, screaming at the top of his voice, Indonesia is mine, the largest Islamic nation in the world. And then in 1998, when I had my encounter with Jesus in Jerusalem, there I received my summons to go to Indonesia. Now, that wasn't the right time to go to Indonesia because Indonesia has just broken out into riots. Those of you know the story, 1998. Okay, the buildings were on fire. Chinese were fleeing out because the Chinese were being hunted down by the Javanese and they were put to the slaughter. Women were being raped. So this was happening. And I received a summons from Jesus in Jerusalem, your next assignment, Indonesia. Indonesia, yes. So I remember flying into Jakarta. And besides me, there were only two others in the plane. And the two others were my intercessors. So when I arrived in Jakarta, I had to walk like this in the airport because people were sleeping there for days on end, waiting for the next flight out, the Chinese. If they get out of the airport, so I went into the city and I called for a meeting and people told me nobody will come, everybody is underground. I said, but the Lord said, that's all I had, but the Lord said. So I summoned for a meeting and we took the largest hall there was, known to us, Shangri-La, 3,000 seating capacity. He says, 30 will not show up. I say, but the Lord said. So we went ahead in faith to organize this meeting. So not 30, not 300, 3,000 showed up plus standing room only. Where they came from, I had no idea. It was dangerous to come. Buildings were still on fire. But they came. And on that night, I released a word for Indonesia. And unknown to me, my message was being transmitted via air. And it has gone to places that I never knew. So the next day, I have a special visitor knocking on my hotel door saying that you are requested to show up at the palace. What palace? The presidential palace. Why? I don't know. But you are requested to be at the palace. So I was imagining the worst. I said, I must have said something. I can't remember. I must have said something that triggered off something. And they're going to revoke my passport. They're going to compound my passport. They're going to ban me from Indonesia. I was imagining the worst. But I was taken to this palace. And when we arrived into the president's room, this was where Suharto was. Walking in, I could feel the demonic presence. That man dabbled with demons. Wow. What they call dukuns. He dabbled with demons. And so I saw and I felt like the demons were staring at me. What is this guy doing here? And I had the same question. What are you doing here? So cut the long story short, Suharto has been dethroned and his deputy became overnight president by default, Habibie. So Habibie, in seeing me, looked right, looked left, asked all his guards to leave. And I said, this is unorthodox. Ask all the guards to leave. Yeah. And then he asked his PA to leave. And they were wondering, I was wondering, what in the world is going on? This is not protocol. You don't know me, I don't know you. But when everyone was gone, the next thing he did was he fell on his knees, took off his sonko, and started to weep uncontrollably. And I was taken aback. What am I supposed to do? I didn't come prepared. And then he said, pray for me, in Bahasa. He said, pray for you. He said, Bapa, Pandetar, I'm a pastor, and I pray in the name of Jesus. He says, yes, that's why I called you. I heard your message last night. Pray for me, please. I'm so very fearful of the bloodshed that is about to happen in the days to come. Please pray for me. I am so very fearful. He was trembling. So I laid hands, prayed. The word of the Lord came and I said, you will be president for a certain number of days, after which you must step down. Imagine me telling that. Telling the president, you will be president for a certain number of days, after which you must step down. Otherwise, there will be bloodshed. Who am I? And I scared myself in saying that. But he received it. And he said, when I need you, I'll call you. Okay. So he left. When he abandoned his office, because he was the interim president, there was an election, and Gusdur, the man who was partially blind, the leader of the largest Islamic group in Indonesia, became the next president. Now, one day I received a call from his PA. Come to the palace. What did I do this time? You know? So, and this man, Habibi, as he was leaving, left my number with this guy. He said, if you're ever in trouble, call this guy. So he called, and I went over, and I said, what can I do for you, sir? And he said, I heard from Habibi, and I need you to pray for me. So I said, sir, I am a pastor. I am a Christian, and I pray in the name of Jesus. And he said, he looked around, he says, I want to tell you a secret. Yes. You know, we Muslims, when we pray, we have to shout to God through the microphone 5 times a day. But you Christians go to your closet and you don't say a word and your prayers are heard. Your prayers are always heard, so pray for me. So I said, hey, what kind of a Muslim leader is this? You know, who's telling me this? Then as I pray, I sensed that I needed to release a word. I said, Baba, Father, you are the Father of Indonesia. And this is the word that I want to share with you. And I hope you can receive it. He says, okay. So I said, let Indonesia be a blessing to Israel. And then I stepped back, fearing the worst. Because you're talking to the largest Islamic nation in the world, and he is the largest leader of the largest Islamic group in Indonesia. And I just said about Israel, I'm in there, all right? And then he began to lean back and laugh hilariously. And then he looked forward and says, but George, I want to tell you a story, Charita. Okay. I didn't know what was coming. So he said, when Indonesia came into independence, August 17, 1945, not one nation, near or far, congratulated President Sukarno on his presidency. Nobody, not one nation. 3 years later, he receives his first congratulatory message. Congratulations, President Sukarno. If you ever need anything, we are here. That message came from David Ben-Gurion, Prime Minister of Israel. First man to congratulate him on his presidency. Sukarno responded in like. He became a friend of David Ben-Gurion, and they began to exchange messages. I said, really? I'm hearing this from the president, okay? Really? Said, yes. Then when Suharto took over from Sukarno as the president of Indonesia in 1965, Sukarno took the relationship 2 steps forward. Not only was he in touch with his counterpart, but the foreign minister, Alam Malik, was in touch with the foreign minister of Israel. I said, really? Yeah. And he has told me, did you know that the Prime Minister of Israel has been to Jakarta and to the home of Suharto? I said, come on. Israelis are not allowed to come to Indonesia. He says, yes, that's what everybody says. But he did come. When? May 1995. Really? Yes. So the Prime Minister of Israel has been to Indonesia? Yes. To his home, not publicly, private home, Suharto. Then he moved to the third and the final part of the story. He said, Pa George, when are you going to Israel next? I said, okay. Can you deliver a letter for me? I said, a letter for you in Israel? Yeah. He said, all right, let me write it out. He wrote a very brief message, sealed it, put it in an envelope, and then wrote the bearer of the envelope. And he said, sorry, go and give it to this man. I took it. Simon Perez, you're writing this letter to Simon Perez? You know Simon Perez? Ha ha ha. Simon Perez and I were buddies. Buddies? Where? In Netanya. What were you doing in Netanya? I stayed in Netanya, studied in Netanya for 2 years. You? Yes. And Simon Perez is your friend? Yes. I said, oh, wow. Through all this time, I was under the impression that the devil had hijacked Indonesia, largest Islamic nation in the world. But here was a man, a Muslim man, telling me, no, the sovereign God had preserved and protected Indonesia. You see, Sukarno's legacy was the Pancasila. He battled one battle all his life. Throughout his time, he fought one battle. What battle? The forces were demanding that Indonesia be declared as an Islamic state. He fought that. He says, no. Not during my watch. Indonesia will never become an Islamic state. So see how the devil was wanting to orchestrate his evil plan upon Indonesia, to declare Indonesia to become an Islamic state. But this one man said no, and he came up with this what we call the Pancasila, the constitution, the manifesto. And that today is preserving this nation. For me, that was the hand of God. And then with Suharto, it was the hand of God coming once again over this nation. And then with Gusdur, and this guy, I know, I tell you, Gusdur, he's a crazy guy. You know, after talking to me, 2 weeks later, he goes to Parliament, you know, and then he pops this question, why can't we be friends with Israel? And everybody's jaw dropped open. 1 week later, he died. That's when I realized, oh my Jesus, the devil was saying, if I let this guy live, this guy will establish this bridge between Indonesia and Israel, and everything that I worked for all this time will be ruined. I cannot allow this, and he killed him. I went for his funeral. And that was a wake-up call to me, never to take this lightly. I repented over the sin, and I said, oh Lord, forgive me. I didn't see this coming. I took it too lightly. Now I understand. When you're trying to bridge a nation with Israel, all hell breaks loose. Yeah, all hell breaks loose. Christian book. I lost a friend. But that taught me something powerful and precious. No nation has been hijacked. by the devil unless the church allows it. Unless the church allows it. I know there's been damage extensively done over Australia, but don't give up on Australia. Don't you ever give up on Australia. If you know your history, then you must know your prophecy. Australia has a place in prophecy. Don't lose your place by default. So even as you're taking time to pray for Israel, pray for Australia.